You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hey, this is Lee Baucom. Welcome to the Save the Marriage Podcast. This is the podcast designed to help you save and restore your marriage no matter where you are in the process, no matter what's going on. This is the podcast designed to help you understand what's happened in your relationship. More than that, how to turn it around. And today I want to talk about, for me, the top 10 myths of marriage. And these are about marriage in general. These myths are some of the reasons why marriages get into trouble, because they're stuck in these myths, these beliefs about marriage that really get us twisted up and get us into bad places. So let's just start off with number one. The first one is a big one, and that is that you marry your soulmate. And this is that belief that there's that one single person on the earth that is the perfect person for you. Now, the reason this is a myth is because it makes an assumption that there is that one single person, and if you find that perfect person, then you don't have to worry about anything else, that it all takes care of itself. Now, I'm not opposed to the idea that you need to find someone with whom you're compatible and with whom you connect and with whom you fit. And, you know, you need to share those common beliefs and common understandings. But this is deeper than that. This is that belief that there is, for some reason, that one single person that completes you, that makes your soul whole, and that somehow is that soulmate. The problem with this, as I see it, is that then when there's trouble, the belief is that you must have not found your soulmate, and it creates this longing to find the correct soulmate. In fact, there's a lot of research that shows that when people are caught in this idea that they have to find their soulmate, that their relationship really does get into trouble. And this is why, because if you believe that it's a soulmate, then it should be easy and there shouldn't be any issues and it should just all click. And that's just not the case. Marriage takes work. Marriage takes effort. And whenever we're able to say, I have found the right person for me, that's great. I'm all for finding the right person for you. And I believe that's something you want to work on. My belief is that before you get married, you make sure that you're marrying the right person. And after you get married, you make it right. And so the right person, though, is different than the soulmate. Do I believe that I have met my most special person, the person I need in my life for my wife? Absolutely. But the belief that it's my soulmate, beyond that, it extends to this place where we believe that there should be no problems. This should be a piece of cake because we are, after all, soulmates. And there is some pretty clear evidence that this belief, this one myth. Now, remember that not every myth is completely false. It's just not entirely true. Myths are not based in fact. They're based in some ideas. And sometimes myths bring us good things. And so this idea that you found the perfect person for you is great. Then you work to make it work. And that's different than believing that there is the one soulmate. And in fact, I found lots of people who are single who are out looking for that the soulmate, and their belief system is so strong that they never find the soulmate instead of finding someone with whom they can love and with whom they can be in love for the rest of their life. Okay, so what's the number two? Number two is it should be easy if it is right. And this is kind of like that belief with a soulmate, but it's the belief that marriage just should be easy. And, you know, if this is the right person, even if it's not, you know, if even you've given up that belief in a soulmate, if it's the right person, it just should be easy. And I hear this all the time. You know, people come to me when they're trying to save their relationship and they say, you know, my spouse says that if it's this hard, it's just not right. And that always baffles me because we don't apply that anywhere else in life. You know, if you set out to get good at a sport, you don't say, well, if it was this hard, it must not be meant to be. You work hard at it. Or if you get into a career, you know, how many times do you want your neurosurgeon to have said, well, this is just so easy. You know, I guess I was just made for this. Or to say, this isn't easy. I'm going to give up on this. Or, you know, how about when you're learning to walk? Well, this is just too hard. You know, it must not be right for me to walk. I must be intended to crawl the rest of my life. It just doesn't happen. How about schoolwork? You know, it just is not the right class for me. I'm going to have to drop it. If you drop every class because it's a little tough, there are not going to be many left. And so for some reason, though, when it comes to marriage, we make it this special category that if it's the right relationship, it should be easy. And the corollary to that is if it's tough, it must be wrong. And that's the dangerous one. And my belief is that marriages take effort. It doesn't have to be drudgery and hard work, but marriages take effort. You know, whenever you find a new hobby, it takes effort, but you probably decide to invest in that because you love that hobby. And it's the same with a marriage. If you love this other person and you love the relationship, why not invest in the hard work to get you there? Okay, well, so number three, the third myth in marriage is never go to bed angry. And this one is one that floats around all the time. I hear people say it at weddings. And, you know, if you just follow this, you'll always be okay. Never go to bed angry. Well, I want you to think back and think about the times when you might have been angry about something, but with a little distance and a little rest, you realize that it was crazy for you to be angry about that, that it was just your frame of mind, that what was driving that argument was something else. Well, guess what? It's true in relationships too. Sometimes you need to let things cool off a little bit. Sometimes you need to go to bed angry and wake up in the morning with a little rest and a little distance and a little perspective on it and recognize that sometimes if we decide to not go to bed angry, we're going to only make things worse because we don't get to the place we need to. Well, why is that? Well, one, probably if you're avoiding bed to get through the angry part, you're already tired. It's probably at the end of a long day. You're probably arguing about something already, and you're thinking that there is some right solution to it. Sometimes we find that there isn't really a solution as much as there's a place of making sure that both people feel heard and both people feel accepted. And so when we have this belief that you don't go to bed angry, then you end up with this place where you're constantly trying to have peace and settle everything instead of giving everything its place to kind of come to a rest. So what I've noticed is a lot of times when something really is bothering us, if we have a little perspective, if we have a little rest, some resources, we recognize that it's not as big a deal and that the anger was perhaps a bit unwarranted. And so my thing is that you don't bury conflict, but you want to make sure the conflict is worth having, instead of getting wrapped up in it. And I've met couples who try to follow this rule, and I've met them in my office because they end up making these small little molehills into huge mountains of conflict just because they've decided they can't go to bed angry. What a myth. Okay, myth number four is that marriage is 50-50. You know, if I put in my half, you put in your half, we're all good. I don't believe that. I believe that marriage is 100-100, that each person has to put in 100%, that you don't wait for the other person to give the other 50%, because that's what 50-50 means. And you're constantly going, you know, are you putting in your fair share? Instead of saying, I'm going to put in my all, I'm going to be invested, I'm going to put in everything I've got, I'm in this. And that's the difference. A 50-50 is a measurement. Are you putting in your half? Am I putting in my half? And usually the way we say it is, I'm putting in more than my half. Why aren't you putting in your part? Rather than saying, I'm not going to judge that. I am just going to be 100% in. And if you have two people who are doing that, what magic? But if not, at least one person needs to be saying, I need to be 100% in. Now, that doesn't mean you're doing 100% of the effort, but that your commitment is 100% in, that you're not looking to measure where the other person is. Okay, so myth number five. Myth number five is an interesting one because the myth is that if there's no passion, then everything or something is wrong. If there's no passion in a relationship, we are doomed. And here's the truth. Passion can come and go. Passion can be much more like the tides, high tide, low tide. You don't always feel passion. And the problem is that what we want to do is compare the beginning of a relationship when all that infatuation and all those chemicals are being dumped into our body by our brains. It makes us feel this great level of passion. And you know, we talk about being madly in love. And when we look at the brain scans of people who are in that madly in love phase, it much looks like a brain that has some mental illness to it, because the places that are firing are just being bombarded by these chemicals, these neurotransmitters in our brain that overwhelm us. But where would society be if that was a permanent state? In fact, it's not possible to have that as a permanent state. Most research shows that the longest that can last is 18 months to 2 years. And after that, there is going to be a shift. And that shift is where a relationship has to recognize that something is happening here. It's maturing. And that the passion in life, the passion in the relationship, doesn't come because of that infatuation, but it becomes from the commitment, and it comes from being loving and doing loving actions. And that the passion isn't going to be there 100% of the time, 100% of the days, 100% of the hours. That there are times when the passion returns because you're doing loving things, and there are times when it might recede some because things aren't so good, but that's just the pattern of relationships. When we always buy into that, oh, I'm not feeling any passion, something must be wrong, then we get into trouble. If we recognize that it is our task to reconnect and to build back to that passion, then we're on to a better path. Okay, number six, the sixth myth of marriage is that a spouse should know what I need. You know, if the spouse loves me and if we're all connected and we've got this mind meld going on, they ought to know what I need intuitively. I don't need to say it. If I have to say it, something's wrong here. I hear this all the time where someone says, you know, if I have to spell out what I want, then something's wrong here. And what I've noticed is that we don't do that, again, anywhere else in life. If you want a job to be different, you talk to someone about changing that job. If you want to get somewhere different, you take action and get there. If you need something different from a friend, you tell the friend, I need something different, or decide not to be a friend. But when we apply it to the relationship, spouses aren't really good about reading minds. As I've noticed, humans aren't really good about reading minds. And sometimes we assume that we're meeting the needs of a spouse. Sometimes we have no idea what that need is. The problem is that when there's this proclamation, you should know what I need. If you loved me, you would love me the way I need to. It's based on a fallacy that we understand the inner workings of someone else and that we are alike. You know, that we see the world alike, that we have this common paradigm, and we can have all the same core beliefs, we can have all the same goals in life, but still what we need, when we boil it down, may be different. And the only way to get what you want is to be clear about that. At least then, if you're clear about it and your spouse says, no, I can't do that, or no, I won't do that, then you're on to a page called reality, which is different than the belief that they should just know intuitively, that somehow they should read your mind and know what you need. Which brings us to myth number seven, that spouses who love each other should always agree. And this is based on a couple of assumptions. One is that any two people are going to agree. Now, I remember in a business class one time, we were talking about different levels of organizations of business, and one was a partnership. And the teacher said, you know, in a partnership, if both people see everything just alike and believe everything just alike and do everything just alike, one of those people is not necessary. And it's kind of the same in a marriage. It's not that one's not necessary, but somebody's not stepping up because we're not going to 100% agree with anybody else in the world. Now, that doesn't mean that there's a problem. In fact, I would argue that two minds thinking and sharing are much more powerful than one mind in a marriage. That's part of the power of a marriage, of two different people seeing things from a different angle and providing that as a deepening of the relationship. The two pieces are much greater than the single parts. When they're put together, the whole of the two is much more powerful than those single pieces. But when we have this belief that we've got to agree, then we create this standard. And usually the agreements are not very deep and they're not very true. Sometimes what we really need is not an agreement, but it's an understanding of each other. Which brings us to myth number eight. We have to agree on these things, parenting. We have to agree on money. We have to agree on sex. We have to agree on really anything. So number seven was we should always agree. That's just, you know, if you're on the same wavelength, then you would just always agree. But the other is that you have to agree on these things. See, I believe that two people parenting together are not going to parent the same way. And that's not a requirement. Now, there have to be some basic agreements with each other, that you agree on some different fundamentals. But I really believe that fathers and mothers, that two different parents are just going to parent differently. That's just how we're made differently, and a child needs both levels. A lot of times you'll see relationships where the mother is the more nurturing and the more careful. That was certainly true in our household. And the father was the more adventuresome and try it out. And so, you know, there were many times when with our kids, I was pushing them to take risks and my wife was pushing them to be careful, and they needed both perspectives. And we didn't have to agree on it piece by piece. Now, I remember one time my son was headed out on a ski trip and my wife said, "Oh, be careful." And I said, "Son, if you don't fall a few times, you're not trying hard enough." He needs both perspectives. And so that's true with parenting. It's true with money. You don't have to agree 100% with what's going to happen with the money. You just have to agree that you're going to get to a decision about it. Or how about sex? You know, that's a big one. I hear that all the time about we don't agree on how to do it. And the question is, can you find a place of understanding of the other person and find an understanding that that's a way of connecting, a bringing you together? And when you face it that way, you don't have to agree 100% on these things. You just have to listen and understand. And that really is the key. There is a difference between agreeing with somebody and them feeling understood. And my push is for people to understand each other, not always to agree with each other, to be able to say, okay, understand where you're coming from, and to be able to tell them where they're coming from and say, I don't agree with you, but I understand. Now let's get to a place where we can find a common place, a common landing spot. Okay, so then that brings us to a really big one. Number 9, infidelity ends a marriage. What a myth. Here's the statistics. Well over 60%, somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% of couples who experience an affair stay married. An affair is not the ending of a marriage. It may be the changing of the relationship. It may bring it to the point where you have to say, okay, what's going on here and what are we going to do? It does fracture the illusion that the marriage is completely secure, and that's an illusion all along, but it doesn't have to end a marriage. In fact, I see many couples who go through an infidelity, whether it's an emotional affair or a physical affair, and come out on the other end actually stronger because they then had to face something and been real with each other. Sometimes for the first time, they've been real with each other. Infidelity comes out of a lack of connection with each other and out of a lack of boundaries to protect the relationship. That's what happens that leads to an affair. And so that points to some places that need to be shored up. There has to be more connection in the relationship, and you have to form bigger boundaries, protective boundaries, so that can't happen again. But it doesn't have to end a marriage. And the last one, number 10, is that communication is the key. It's not that I don't think communication is important. I do believe that people should be able to communicate, but here's what I mean by that. If you go to a lot of therapy sessions or retreats or trainings, it's all about communication, and you learn to do I messages, and you learn all these great techniques of communication, and nothing changes in the relationship because it's not about communication. It's about perception. How you perceive each other. Are you seeing each other as doing the best each other can, that you're doing the best you can, your spouse is doing the best you can, not as optimal performance, but you're doing the best you can given the state of mind right then, given where you are right then, you're doing the best you can. That's a perception. The other perception is to say, you know what, you're not doing what you could. You're being mean to me. You're against me. You hate the relationship. I mean, there are lots of perceptions that can creep in there, and those perceptions are much more powerful than the communication. As I sat in many a session where the couple would come in and say, hey, we need your help. We need you to teach us communication skills. And they'll talk to me for 15, 20 minutes. I understand every single word they say, and they understand every single word each one says. It is not a difference of understanding of communication. Communication is just the conduit. It's just the pipes of taking information from one person to the other. That's not the issue. The issue is whether that communication is going through perceptions that change the meaning, that change what's going on. And communication is what I say to you. Perception is how you perceive what I said. And that's the link. If you don't tackle the misperceptions, the paradigms that cripple us, communication isn't going to help at all. Okay, those are the top 10 myths of marriage. I'm going to have several other top 10 lists as the weeks come by. And the next one that we're going to talk about are the top 10 myths of marital therapy. Now, if you have said, you know what, I have bought into some of those myths of marriage, I want to change that. Let me invite you, grab the Save the Marriage system. You can find a link right below. That Save the Marriage system will give you a true understanding of what marriage is meant to be, how it can go well, how it can destroy these top 10 myths of marriage, and how you can make sure those myths never limit you again. So just below, if you're reading or right above, if you're listening, you will find the links to the Save the Marriage system. This is Lee Balcom wishing you the best as you work to save your marriage.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.